Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, March 27th, 2004. Today's session is entitled Creation, the Second Practice of the Lutheran Outdoor Ministry Association Retreat, session number LOMA 2004-02. Let's listen in.
And before you start, I really would like to be able to introduce Kristen, who was with us last night to see when you were there. Kristen Gilia is our village artist, and this is one of her works up here on the wall. One of her several responsibilities is to create art every year that expresses our theme, which Janet said was summing out with We Shall Be. And it's a very unique and challenging way of developing art, but I have to brag, she just came back from Yale Divinity School where she was asked to bring her silk banners and lecture on art developed in the community. So, and please feel free to join me.
They gave you an honorary doctoral.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I expect chocolate now every day.
We were real proud of you for that. Interesting in studying the book of Ephesians, one commentator explained how Ephesians is really what in ancient Greek-Roman culture was called the epideictic speech. And an epideictic speech was like a banquet speech where you gathered someone in a certain guild or something, and then the speaker would praise them and tell them what a great job they are doing, encourage them, build them up, and then build it up to a great conclusion. Therefore, do it more and more. And it's interesting to read the book of Ephesians that way, if you think it's maybe written to discourage Christians after the fall of Jerusalem, and how all through it is this kind of building them up, you know, all that you have received and all of your gifts, and then builds it up to, therefore, put on the whole armor of God, and you just walk out of that banquet hall, you know, just feeling, so I'm going to do a little of that, and I won't be really excited, because I've said this, I'm a Swedish male, and when I'm really excited, you don't know it.
I'm staring at the other person's shoes.
But, so I'll read it. But this is thank you to all of you for my experience with church camping, and I'm sure this is true of generations and generations, that church camping has been not studying creation with a book or textbooks, but creation itself and being in the midst of creation. The generations who have been connected through church camping. And I have my memories myself as a teenager in, we rented a camp, church camp, and it was Camp Abe Lincoln. And it was on the bluffs overlooking the Mississippi River.
YMCA camp.
Yeah, YMCA camp. And I remember just as a teenager sitting on those bluffs looking over the great expanse, and sometimes we would go there for the sunset. And then sometimes we would sing Day is Dying in the West, and I tried to rewrite the words, and I never realized it at that time, the rich metaphors in that song. Do they still sing it? Day is Dying in the West. But it's Day is Dying in the West, Heaven is Touching Earth to Rest. Wait and worship while the night sets her evening lamps abright. Isn't that the poetry of that? You know, and then through all the sky, and then holy, 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 and I forgot the rest. Lord God of hosts,
heaven and earth are full of thee. Heaven and earth are praising thee. Holy woman, most by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I remember that, looking up over that expanse. And the other thing I remember about that is looking around and the other boys who had found the girlfriend were holding hands singing this. It reminds me of Tim's experience that's on page. Here's my bag. On page 90, this was the chapter on creation, and the reviewer in Christian Century says some chapters are better than others in this book, and this, if you only read several chapters, don't miss this one, of that description of the night out on the boat and the quietness in the San Francisco Bay. And then the teenager that is part of the writing then is Tim, described an early morning at camp in the Berkshire Hills of Massachusetts. He woke up at dawn and took a solitary walk through the woods. He came upon a meadow and sat down. The woods were so still and quiet, he actually felt like he was part of them, that the trees and the shrubs breathed the same air and shared the same ground as he. He felt reverent, as if God were present in that very moment, at that very place, and he wanted to pray. But he didn't need to find a prayer to say. The silent sense of being at one with the woods was the prayer itself. I am amazed at how many church camps are named after Philip Melanchthon.
One of us.
One of us. I was trying to write down some of them. See what I missed. But Luther Wood, Luther Press, Luther Haven, Luther Heights. Did I miss any?
Luther
Point.
Luther Point.
Park. Luther Springs.
Luther Point.
Park. Springs.
Luther Crest.
Ismuth. Luther Ismuth. Moraine.
Luther Rock.
Luther Rock.
Luther Ridge.
Luther Rock.
Luther Road.
Luther
Memorial.
And I was Memorial. Oh, yeah. There's a Luther Memorial Camp.
In Ohio.
Okay. And to think, you know, that Luther was the same time as Columbus. You know, they were contemporaries. And I often wonder if Katie heard about this and said, you know, someday there'll be camps all over that land. Named after you. What I'd like to do is connect this chapter with Luther, and what a tradition in the writings of Luther and the sermons of Luther that connect to creation that in some ways have been lost. What I'm going to share is the inspiration from some of the inspiration from Robert Gaiser, who taught Luther studies at PLTS, and also by Stephen Churchill for an academic article on this lovely music of nature, grounding an ecological ethic in Martin Luther's creation mysticism. And I think if we go to this and then realize our camps are named after Luther, what a word he has to remind us to live in creation with a sense of awe and wonder. So I'm going to just read some of the quotes from creation and from Luther. God's own divine nature is wholly and entirely in all creatures and in every single individual being, more deeply, more inwardly, more present than the creature is to itself. God is in the creature which he creates and in which he works, but we pay no heed. God is in all creatures, even the smallest flowers. We do not marvel at the wonderful light of the sun because it is a daily phenomenon. We do not marvel at the countless other gifts of creation, for we have become deaf to this wonderful and most lovely music coming from the harmony of the motions that are in the celestial spheres. He's quoting what I think is a Greek, ancient Greek philosopher, Pythagoras. So, but because we continually hear this music, we become deaf to it. We have verily become deaf to this lovely music of nature. Christ is present in all places, even in the very smallest leaf, in each created thing, within and without, around it and with its sinews, beneath and above, before and behind. If the stars did not rise during every single night, how great a gathering would there be for this spectacle? Now not one of us even opens a window. Just a few comments now that in Luther's teaching that sin is non-trust and sin is separation from God and from others and from nature or the non-human creation. Sin isolates us from nature. And instead of awe and wonder, the natural person or the old self is terrified by nature. And Luther liked to say, human beings jump in fear at the rustling of a leaf. And therefore they thingify nature and they seek domination. They seek to own it and control it and to use magic, which Robert Geiser called, when Luther said magic, he was talking about early technology, human manipulation. When we are justified by grace through faith, we are reconciled to God. We are reconciled to others by faith, active in love, and reconciled to the entire non-human creation. Now, in the carrying on of the teaching of Luther after his death, the first two were carried on, and number three, in essence, died with Luther. And I'd like to give some examples of that and also some stories. One example I have in my life, my father was a Lutheran pastor. And if you're a PK, those of you who are not, you grow up, your entire growing up, only hearing one preacher. There's no hope for somebody. One preacher. And my father, he loved nature and loved creation, and he was very intentional about getting us out into creation. And he had one class in college on geology and one on astronomy. And I have these memories of being out on a starry night, and my father just in awe before the stars and telling us about them, or stopping to look at a geological area. We were early campers We got our first family camping tent in 1946. This was primitive back then, but it was part of our being out in nature and creation. So that's one side. The other side, I don't remember any sermon from my father on creation.
Yeah.
Because there was this separation. His sermons were very, he had a Luther Tower experience in his youth, you know, of having what he called assurance of salvation. You know, and he was so committed to helping people have that similar experience. And but creation was basically left out of it. There was a separation between the two. Now, I had an experience in my life where this kind of came home to me, and in the whole law gospel words of Lutheran theology, this would be the law side. But it was when I was serving this congregation in San Diego. We were Spring Valley, which was kind of the eastern edge of San Diego area. And once I pulled up into the church parking lot, which was kind of gravel, I got out of my 64 red Dodge Dart, two-door with stick shift, and got out. And then right before me when I stepped out was a big plaque, according to my thought, ugly tarantula spider crawling by. And I immediately I was at the edge of the parking lot, and there's a big rock about this big. And I picked that rock up and I dropped it on this, because the only thing that flashed in my mind was poisonous, mean, James Bond movie that I had seen. Remember the one with the tarantula crawling up his arm? That's what I remember. And then here was this thing just squashed. And then I went into my office to prepare sermons and do the Lord's work. But I remember sitting there, and all of a sudden it started to bother me. You know, it just started to, and I kept thinking, and I said, well, I'll atone for this by reading about tarantula. So I went to the library. This is atonement. So atonement. Found out this tarantula was migrating to Mexico as part of the migratory path. Found out how this tarantula fit into the whole order of nature. And then also found out that to be bit by a tarantula spider is about like a bee sting. That's how serious it is. And it was that experience that really connected me to creation. But I kept slipping back, you know, I quit killing tarantulas.
Small stuff.
And I remember years later coming up here to Holden, and that first year I was here, 79-80, for a year. We were really involved with John Howard Yoder's The Politics of Jesus. This was a major textbook of discussion, which was a powerful book, but there wasn't a lot about creation in John Howard Yoder's Way of the Cross. But this is what we focused on. And then in 1984, when I was back in Albuquerque, Jenny Witt, Tom's mom, was it the summer of 84 when she was diagnosed?
No.
83?
She was diagnosed in 82.
Diagnosed with terminal cancer. And so in 84, she was close to death, and she invited different people to come to see her. And Karen and I were very honored to be invited. And so we flew to Chicago. And this would be a whole other story, but if you ever want a story of dying in a beautiful, faithful way, is to read the story of Jenny's dying. We could just sit and tell stories, couldn't we? But I'll just tell one. She was sitting in the living room and saw these grim people coming out of a car to visit her in the front. And she says, "Oh my goodness, they're coming. I better get to bed and look like I'm dying." My clothes survived that. That's right. But when I went in, and I had 20 just wonderful minutes with Jenny. And she had a speech prepared for everybody, you know, because you have a certain power, don't you, when you're dying? And she looked up at me and she says, "Dan, in all your teaching about the theology of the cross, don't forget creation." You know, and I think since that moment, you know, I've wanted Virginia to make this our connectedness with God's creation and Luther's third thing that's been forgotten, to let that be in the center. Now, I'll close this little part with a little Luther writes a prayer, and this is in the book, and this is Eugene, age 6, in Children's Letters to God. "Dear God, I never thought that purple and orange really went together until I saw your sunset last night. That was cool." Yeah. So that can be the opening then to our sharing. And looking forward to hearing how church camp is used with all ages as a way to help people with connection to creation. Margie, where are you? Oh, there. So, turn it over. Yeah.
Then 3-year-old last summer said, "I don't know why God created mosquitoes. I don't think she had a very good idea that day." It struck me what you were saying, Dan, about the disconnect, you know, talking about your dad and some of the conversions you've had yourself. And sometimes I think in outdoor ministries we've done a good job of the practice of caring about creation in our practices, whether it's our architecture or our food or whatever. But it struck me again when I read the chapter 2 about how do you instill the whole piece of caring about creation, and then how do we help young people, all people, take that home? There's a disconnect sometimes with what we practice at camp, and then how do they take that home? I'm just curious about how you help instill that in your campers.
And not only that, but to see that as a holy thing, or a holy act.
I think a lot of folks don't see it as a holy act, they see it as a political act.
Yeah.
And as soon as you start talking about caring for creation, you begin to be labeled tree hugger or environmentalist and whatever. I think that talking about these kinds of things is avoided at times because you don't want to politicize what you're doing at camp. It's nice to have some Luther backing, you know, that can help. I think that's one of the reasons for the disconnect.
Mm.
One thing I forgot to mention with the Luther is, and this probably is obvious, but how close you can see how that affected his understanding of the sacraments.
Say more about that.
An example would be his, who was the other reformer?
Zwingli?
Yeah,
Zwingli, thank you, Zwingli. His arguments with Zwingli over the presence of Christ in the sacraments, and Zwingli scoffing at the fact that if the body of Christ is in every communion in 10,000 churches, he tried to figure out how many stories high the body of Christ is, just to sound ludicrous. Yes, and it was really this creation spirituality that we came back with, If Christ is present in every part of creation, and he used the Old Testament, the whole earth is full of the glory of God, then how could Christ not be in the bread and the wine? And it wasn't our words that puts Christ in, but Christ is already there along with all of creation, but it's a promise connected to the seal that makes it sacrament. And the I had a quote once, and Luther quotes, you hear them and you have no idea where they come from, but it was that Luther once said to Zwingli, Christ is present in the bread and wine because Christ is present in my cabbage soup.
That's good. That's creation.
But I might maybe made that up.
At least Luther would have said.
Yeah. 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 I heard it.
Strongly about it, I wouldn't open my mouth, but I worked for 8 years in a boarding school for kids in trouble. We did a lot of wilderness work, and even there they were afraid of politicizing. And if you can't talk about care of creation, God's sacred creation, in a church camp, yeah, where can you talk about it? I mean, Christianity needs to take a stand on the Christian values. And if we're Lutheran people, and going back to Luther's word, we need to take a stand because nobody else is. Nobody else is. And there's ways of, diffusing the politicalness of it. But if you're teaching a value, that's really important. What are camps without teaching values?
True.
Thank you. Thanks, Phyllis.
What I've heard is I've just been with directors here for a little while. There's a lot of talk about numbers and money and things like that. And when you begin to do those are realities, those are things you really get hit with. And when you think about wanting to keep those things up and moving and flowing, well, you don't want to rock the boat too much, You want to keep it pretty broad and not send children home telling their parents to stop acting a certain way because it's bad for the environment. They won't send them back to camp, Numbers go down.
I don't think that's true at all. I don't think it happens that way. I think when we have been bold about it, we've talked about it, and kids sometimes have gone back and told their parents that maybe we ought to start recycling and maybe we ought to do this, and I think it's been a very receptive response. I don't think it has anything to do with numbers or anything else. It never has in my experience anyway. And I've certainly been an advocate caring about the creation and building it into the curriculum or whatever we have at Captain and the learning experience. When I first got into Captain with the church, I wrote a book for the church called church camp at work, and I was called by Warren Quambeck, who was on the Augsburg Publishing Board. I was called a pantheist, and I didn't even know what the hell I was. I went back and asked. I said, you're calling me this. What are you talking about? And it was that whole inclusion of the whole sense of creation, being a part of it, that the Lutheran Church has always struggled, had lots of trouble with, and like it leaves out a piece, which I feel is vital, and more vital at this time than it's ever been in the life of our country. This is not a time to waffle. If you believe strongly in that God made this creation and gave it to us and entrusted us for the care of it, this is a critical time in the life of this nation of ours about those issues. We have a president who's rolled back environmental laws that many of us struggled for years to put in place. And it's done it with subterfuge and lies. And if we don't stand up now, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves.
I actually think there's another part of this that's even more difficult for Lutherans. This is related to your initial comments about we won't know if you're excited. Because I think part of what is expressed specifically in Luther is the mystical experience of God in the experience of oneness with nature. And I think it's definitely an area that we could do more with. I think a mystical experience in childhood is not unusual. I think it's practically natural. It's the entry point. But the reluctance to talk about it, to bless it, you know, I mean, we don't have these practices about the vision quest. You go out and, you know, we don't acknowledge it. And I just was reading a research thing on mysticism in which, whatever the sample was, it was in this country, it was something like 80% of the sample identified that they had had a mystical experience in childhood or in adolescence. And something like 30% were ever interested in having that experience again. And that this, maybe it's back to the tarantulas, this great fear and awe, fear of the Lord, sort of sense of being overwhelmed and caught up. We don't speak easily about that experience being true and real and natural, and isn't that wonderful? You know, and yet I would think that it's very common probably in our camp and here. So, and then on the other, a very practical thing, I mean, one of the most difficult things for me to deal with here in terms of children is the torturing of chipmunks. And chipmunks are a tremendous pest here. And, you know, every week there are kids out there chasing, capturing, throwing rocks at. And if we've got a teachable moment ever, and how we could take that moment into an invitation rather than don't do that, how we could make those moments bloomed, you know, in a way that might open something up in terms of care of creation. It's the first example that came to my mind.
And the extension of that is the adults also chase them or throw things at them, or at least call them bad names. And going back to the idea of, you know, that we talked about last night, of leading.
Well, I was even thinking of a tour, maybe we could have chipmunk studies.
Yeah,
chipmunk studies.
That's a good idea.
Dissection.
Yeah, and I appreciated your comments too about what Luther was saying about creation. I think one of the things that is troublesome sometimes to me, and I've heard from other directors too, is we have this notion that we have to be so second article heavy, you know, and that we get scared of getting into the other articles, especially the first one, maybe for fear of coming across as a pantheist or something. I remember Lauren Tague talking about trying to clean up wilderness canoe bases theology, you know, because they were so creationist in their emphasis. It was becoming a turnoff because it wasn't balanced, they felt, enough with the second article stuff. But I think we have to be conscious of that, but not, you know, it's so easy to get out of balance, I think, and that's a big part of it for me. And I suppose, you know, we err on the side of the second article to the detriment of the others. And it was just helpful to hear Luther's emphasis on creation too, because I think we always hear the second article stuff.
Yeah, and there's a way that he never separated the two articles, you know, with his sacramental theology. It's the ordinary that bears the sacred. So you, with Luther, you couldn't even talk about the second article without it's the word became flesh.
Are there some good?
I mean, I think intentionally we've been calling ourselves outdoor ministries, you know. I mean, that's intentional.
I wish you could we get a copy of that stuff you were.
Yeah.
Please. Well,
that would be so helpful, Dan.
Yeah, the mysticism, creation mysticism.
No, the pieces that you read.
The quotes.
Oh, yeah, I could make them up. And it was, this came from a current, so 1999.
Wow.
The article was.
Steve Churchill is a colleague of mine.
Yes, I don't know.
I have quotes I can send out to everybody. I have copies of that kind of stuff. But he's printed up.
Yeah.
Does it make a difference because are the youth we're dealing with like more urban? I mean, for a long time our tradition, the Lutheran tradition, came out of a rural culture where we had a touchstone about the earth that was very different than the cell phone thing that we were talking about. And then what does that call us to be in that different context? I'm not sure, but I think there is something about that, about kids not even connecting cows with milk.
Yeah.
I mean, real simple stuff that they don't know, and probably have no, I mean, they have no understanding of the role of the chipmunk in the.
And this is, you know, it's changed, but I remember a seminary professor, A.D. Matson was his name, that was invited to preach at a rural church. It probably would have been in Florida. And after the service, he said he wanted to meet with all the farmers in the church basement. So they stayed. And so he talked to them about the connection of their faith with their farming. And one of them just started crying. And I remember saying this, that this farmer said, never have we ever talked about this in church.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Church is where you go to hear about, heaven.
Yeah,
that's
what you're doing wrong.
And it was so astounding. It was just tears. Which was kind of, again, to what I said about the disconnection after the death of. Mm-hmm. Now much more is being done in rural ministry. I mean, that's changed, I think.
Well, I think the people always knew it, whether the clergy knew that, but the people, I think.
People did.
Yeah.
People did. that they didn't bring, you didn't bring it to church to talk about.
Well, you didn't know how to talk about it.
Yeah, they didn't talk about it.
They're farmers, they don't go around giving speeches.
You know, when you talk about care of creation and trying to teach that at camp to kids from the cities or from suburbs, beyond, talk about recycling, educate about recycling, talk about maybe water conservation or trying to help understand that. What are some other things that, some practical things that could be brought out to help kids? Ralph.
Thank you. No, I was just going to say, I've been trying to jump in on the conversation here too by saying that in recent years, it's like I've been reflecting on the whole tradition and structure in outdoor ministries and how it perhaps has prevented me from doing outdoor ministries. Okay, because, you know, you work with staff and they've got somehow these traditions that recycle over 20 years and people say, well, you know, we all have to go to bed and get ready for bed at 10 o'clock after campfire, and, you know, we have this tradition of dismissing them quietly and they can walk back to the cabin. Then we all have devotions in our cabins. You know, we get all of these kind of systems in place so that nobody feels even free to go out and lay in the meadow and look at the stars. And I think part of it is as we've grown from small group to large group, we start getting more of these systems, and I've been trying to break them up in recent years and give freedom and flexibility. And so the debates in our full-time staff is how to get kids into these settings where they can actually have one of these experiences. And I'm surrounded by some of the most beautiful settings that I've ever been in. And I couldn't understand why no one could sit by a waterfall in silence at 11 o'clock is, well, you know, they're supposed to be in their cabin at 10 and have devotions. You know what I mean? And so if we start taking off some of those blinders, I don't know if, yes, we have a nature program that tries to teach, but I think it begins with a more soulful thing, a sense of appreciation, a sense of awe, and holiness that comes by having the freedom to get out of those buildings and get out of those big groups and wander in the dark and you know, write your risk management policy on the side. You know what I'm saying? Because we keep funneling people and kids into these systems and say, well, you know, you got from 3 to 4 when every animal in the world is asleep, but that's when we do nature study. You know, we don't take advantage of the very places that we have, and if it's your pond up there, or even those mosquitoes that somebody brought up, and the noise that they can make at night. But I don't know. Here I am sitting here after 30 years thinking I did it wrong for 28.
I think you got a good point, Ralph. And I mean, I experienced that with the younger staff too. You know, you think that they would be the ones that would take on, but yet they're more structured and you know, set in what they want. You know, and yes. Yeah, take them out and show them bats at night. Let them see that. You know, they're there.
And I don't know if we have to dissect it all the time and explain it. You know, the nature person who wants to take something that is a beautiful mystery and explain it away, and these are the 5 things you should know when you go home. But if you love it, you're going to think twice about throwing your napkin out on the grass or something. And Dr. Ruth Hine, who helped us so much in Wisconsin, she did this regional Are you still doing like those naturalist workshops and stuff like? But she always had this thing up on the board, and you started with appreciation. Mm-hmm. That's where you start, mm-hmm. you know. And you don't start with the science. And she was a scientist, and she says that it never works with kids. It's like you're on your knees, and you're looking at bugs, and you're letting them eat dirt.
You know, I'm encouraged now. Go to the University of Florida in Gainesville, 30 miles away, and get some ologist to come out at night and work with the kids with the palmetto bugs and the roaches and the silverfish. Because I'll never forget when I was in Texas in the 70s, Wendy Jarvis showed me how to get the La Cucaracha roach that's on the side wall. He said you have to grab your ankle so that you can guide your foot.
You know, Ralph, that really resonates with me, what you said regarding our focus on environmental education and, you know, just our focus of camp now not being about the awe and just wonder of nature and our surroundings. It's so true. I mean, a lot of what I know I've focused things on in the last few years have been, yeah, we got to get that recycling program in place, and we've got to do this and we got to do that. But in a lot of ways, those things serve kind of a blinder mentality about recycling within the context of our built-up modern society. If you kind of follow me, it we have to recycle so we can have more stuff and not use as many resources, but there's kind of a disconnect there between that kind of environmentalism and the kind of awe and wonder environmentalism that I think we ought to be about, you know. And yeah, I think one of the reasons why I'm at where I'm at is because I really had that experience when I was younger, and I don't know if that's really what we're giving
today. Well, last summer, I had this pastor who called and said, would you mind if I brought my wife with to camp? I said, no, of course not. And then he said, well, can she help? She's a poet. Or a poet wannabe. She doesn't really have much published, but I said, well, sure. Well, in comes this 60-year-old lady, school teacher, who told me that, you know, her kids really didn't like her all that much because she's been there forever. And, you know, she had this little feeling that she didn't know if she'd be successful. And she was the best naturalist I've ever seen. She had these kids writing poems about fireflies and hummingbirds, and we had this big poetry reading. And every worship had liturgies that were written by kids. Beautiful, beautiful poetry. And I just marveled that, you know, she had this way of opening eyes to experiences. And it's not just first and second article. Luther was the Trinitarian. And what I'm talking about is, I think it's the third article experience that really ignites kids with a passion for creation. You know, it's like a spirit-driven thing that all of a sudden they're creative and they're up.
What about the poetry of Christ being present even in the little flower? With young people.
It was there.
Huh?
It was, you know, there. One of the poems, I wanted to publish them. We did publish them in our newsletter, but one of them was that the presence of God in the breeze. We have a hummingbird farm. And these kids can get hummingbirds to eat out of their hands and out of their mouths. I know you're not supposed to do that. So we have a pastime. But anyways, they had the breath of God in the wind, from the flap of the wind. You know, so, I mean, it's not even the object, but what they felt. And I'm saying, wow, that's God in all things.
Yeah.
Even the breath, even picking up on the holy concept of breath and life. You know.
I'm sitting here feeling guilty about all of the Japanese beetles, like squash them. Wisconsin's infected with these Japanese beetles that look like ladybugs that are everywhere, and they smell awful. And
we have them too.
And it's like there's, you know, I kill 10 of them and like run my kitchen sink daily. Just trying to get rid of the things, but they're always there. Where is God in the Japanese beetle?
Well, I mentioned this time that is this an excuse that nature has its own way of limiting different species? And sometimes we can be servants of God.
Right.
it's also a symbol of man's trying to manipulate nature, because they were introduced to try to get rid of something else.
Yeah.
And they were so successful that they've become the pest.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, what's going to be the balance to get this rid of these things? And you have to vacuum them up, their carcasses in the cedar lodge upstairs. I mean, you just have to vacuum them. It's awesome.
My kids have stopped going to church camp, and the reason why is because they've been looking for the experience that you're talking about, God's breath on the wind. They've been looking for deep connection with mystery and awe, and what they're receiving when they go to camp that they talk about, when I ask them, why don't you want to go this year? They feel that they're that mystery and awe is being replaced by something at a different level. It's the camp songs that they sing over and over and over. They don't feel like they're getting any depth. And what they are looking for is that experience of mystery. And so I mourn that for my kids, because I had that too when I was growing up.
We're kind of caught in a spiral right now. It seems like we recruit like 7 naturalists every spring, because we do a lot of work with the schools, and then gear up for the summer naturalist program. So we've got a year-round nature center. There's about 5,000 kids that go through it. But very few of the ones that respond to our ads are Christians. There is this disconnect between first and second article. You know, they're New Age thinkers. They're Unitarians. Very few Christians that seem to be able to integrate Christology with creation. And so, as a result, I don't say we discourage their spirituality, but it's a little embarrassing that there's no Christian nature then coming out of those nature center programs.
It seems even in our summer Bible camp programs that we do that to ourselves too, because we have Bible study and then we have nature time and then we have games or whatever. And so nature time is 1 hour a day instead of the entire day.
And I think too, we have to, if we're going to instill this awe of creation, which will help us in our practices of why we don't litter, why we don't, I feel strongly about, we have to practice that ourselves as leaders with staff, in staff training, because they haven't laid out in the meadow and looked at the stars. And the more Jerry just instilled this in me, that if you're going to have any staff person do anything with kids, you've got to have them do that themselves during staff training, so they have the idea of doing it. And sometimes we miss that because we have to do so much of the risk management stuff and all the things, that when do we just have the time with the staff to take them on a night hike and say, any one of you can lead a night hike, and this is how it's done, you know, and you learn how to do it as you practice it. That has to be intentional. Okay, any final comment?
No.
Jeff, you're closing us today?
I am.
Chris is.
You don't know.
Oh. Never mind. Dan, I'm sorry.
This maybe is a strange encouragement to you, but on Whidbey Island, Christians are notorious for being missing at in the different environmental groups. Mm-hmm. And the few Christians who are there are realize they're in such a small, small minority. So this isn't just outdoor ministry.
No.
This is.
They ask you why you're there. And when I go to these meetings, yeah. What are you doing here? You're a Christian, aren't you? Yeah, but why is it so strange that we've never connected at all? Well, we've done a good job of connecting some of the other stuff. We've never really taken the time to think through the connections and how to articulate it. So we're kind of stay away from it because we're not in control. We don't understand the subject. And we don't live it or think it within the context of who we are as God's people. You're right. I've had that happen with Sierra Club, Wilderness Society. I mean, you can go through that. Wendell Berry, many years ago, wrote an article on the connectedness of it. I don't know whether any of you have read Wendell Berry. Some of you, I know Ralph has, some of you. And he got, in the letters to the editor in the next magazine, that was Sierra Magazine, and the letters to the editor were just black. How could he even think about putting it together? Christians were the worst polluters in the world. They didn't give a damn about creation. They wanted to dominate creation. I mean, the whole list of, I always thought he must have just been so overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, Wendell Berry was invited to hold him on Sunday. His response, this sounds Wendell Berry, but his response when all the Lutheran churches in America will dig up their parking lots, but they paved over, then he'll come to hold them.
Yeah.
So I guess that was that. just one encouragement, though. I have a member of our church is very, very conservative, so he gives me a subscription to Christianity Today in hopes that it will help me. but it's quite amazing among evangelicals, and this is a fairly recent, of the environmental concern that is coming out of evangelical churches. So I take this and I said, wow, great article in Christianity. But it is encouraging that there is a sense of this changing.
I want to just follow this for a second. If any of you get Sojourner magazine, have any of you ever read Sojourner? The last magazine was nothing but environmental articles.
And then there's in Seattle, which I think has a nationwide mailing list, is. The Earth Ministry. Mm-hmm. Mostly comes out of the Episcopal churches, but Earth Ministry has a passion for helping congregations become environmental concerned. One last thing is the concern here of Holden Village, which shows how close it comes to us, but on the faculty, the last several summers have been, I forgot the name of the science of weather.
Climatologist, and the
prediction, very scientifically studied prediction for this, was it in 20 years, the glacier?
40 on the outside.
What?
40 years on the outside, yeah. Somewhere between 25
and 20. 20 and 40, that the glaciers that surround and feed Railroad Creek and give this village its electricity and power will basically be gone. And it hurts to think that millions of years it's an idea of how this finally really impinges on us. And already are they talking about what do we do?
We have a science and technology committee that's already trying to talk about an alternative clean form of energy that can substitute for the year-roundness of our hydroelectric plant.
Mm-hmm. Thank you all very much. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
we'll have a break for about a half an hour after Chris closes our time.
And just if I could make two announcements so that the rest of your day can fall into place. It's certainly started out beautiful in terms of anyone that wants to go snowshoeing or skiing. Just a reminder that the place you can borrow equipment is up around Lodge 3, but you also can borrow, like Worski, yeah, with the size 13 boots. Another system, I've got a couple pairs of snowshoes that anyone can borrow. If you've got big feet or whatever, you know, that you need, we have a pad on the podium you can always just talk to staff, but there is a pad on the podium where we make announcements for meals, and if you want to say something like, I've got size 13 and I'd love to ski, does anybody have some boots I could borrow? That's another system where you can find someone on staff, or just go up and talk to people. If anybody wants my snowshoes, you're welcome to do that. The other thing in regard to, can we get a copy of what he wrote, I forgot to mention that all of these sessions are being taped in Drew Holden tradition, and so they are available by CD at the end of things on Monday. So if you have any interest, you should go into the bookstore in that little window we have this afternoon and fill out a form that would say, you know, I want a set of CDs of the sessions. The end of it, they're 80 minutes, so the end's going to get a little bit cut off. But if you're wanting in some way to use, especially the initial part that you've prepared, Dan, that's available. But you'd have to let them know today if you want to go home with them on Monday.
Any small feet want to borrow these snowshoes?